Hey everyone, I'm Thanos Davelis, and welcome back to our podcast, The Greek Current, for your daily roundup, where we highlight the top stories of the day every afternoon with analysis from guest experts, policymakers, journalists, and HALC staff. In a shocking move earlier this month, Berat Albayrak, Turkey's finance minister and Erdogan's son-in-law, announced his resignation after months of growing alarm over the value of Turkey's currency and the state of the economy. His abrupt departure has triggered a shakeup in the country's economic management and raises questions about Turkey's political and economic future. Laura Patel, the Turkey correspondent for the Financial Times based in Ankara, joins us to discuss her latest in-depth piece on this shocking development, Erdogan's family drama, and the future of Turkey. Laura, welcome to the Greek Current podcast. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on.
A former AKP member of parliament said that Berat Albayrak, Turkey's finance minister and Erdogan's son-in-law, represented the ultimate power. He was Alpha and Omega. Now he doesn't exist. Can you walk us through the events that took place over the last couple of weeks that led to the sudden announcement by Berat Albayrak that he was resigning from his position as finance minister?
Yeah, I mean, it's been an incredibly turbulent couple of weeks in Turkish politics, and one that's taken pretty much everybody, I think, by surprise. As that former AKP was saying, this guy was incredibly powerful. I think the second most powerful person in the Turkish government after Erdogan. And a lot of people also thought that he was being groomed potentially as Erdogan's successor. I mean, you can talk about how plausible a plan that was, but, you know, he certainly was given a lot of prominence and a lot of responsibility by his father-in-law, and now he's gone. So, I mean, the events that led up to this were a steady decline in the economic situation, and particularly the currency. By the start of November, the Turkish lira had lost about 30% of its value against the dollar. You know, and that comes on the back of like previous sharp depreciations in previous years, including the currency crisis in 2018. And in Turkey, the wider public follows the exchange rate very, very closely. It's something that affects people's lives because it affects inflation and the cost of living. This is a country very heavily reliant on imported goods. And so, you know, an increase in the exchange rate translates very quickly into something that ordinary people can feel. And so I think there was a lot of heat from the public and also within the ruling party over this situation. The economy also has all sorts of other problems, like caused by the coronavirus pandemic, the dwindling foreign currency reserves, which was a source of great concern for foreign investors. And then the weekend before last, there was this surprise and sudden announcement by President Erdogan that he was sacking the central bank governor and replacing him with a guy called Naci Ağbal, a former bureaucrat turned politician who was known for quite market-friendly views and was also a known critic, at least in private, of Berat Albayrak. And 24 hours later, we heard that Berat Albayrak had announced his resignation on Instagram. Seemingly, he was very unhappy about the decision to appoint Naci Ağbal as central bank governor. He resigned. 27 hours later, after basically more than a day of silence, President Erdogan accepted the news, and suddenly he appears to be out of the political picture, which is a big surprise to many people, including me.
Laura, you talked about how the economy and the lira in particular has tumbled under Albayrak's stewardship of the finance ministry. How did Turks react to the news?
I think it depends who you were asking. I mean, I think the opposition were fairly gleeful. Opposition parties have seen Albayrak as a very easy target over the last couple of years because, you know, they would argue that he got his position only because he was President Erdogan's son-in-law. They held him up as an example of nepotism in the AKP era. They said he was incompetent. They laughed at him, both for the policies that he enacted and his mannerisms, the way he talked, the things he said on TV. So they were pretty jubilant, although I do wonder if they might miss him now that he's gone because he was such an easy figure for them to attack. And, you know, opposition supporters in the wider public were the same. From ruling party type figures and, you know, their supporters, their kind of pro-government journalists and commentators, there was mainly silence, you know, in the immediate aftermath because the pro-government media and the state media didn't report on the resignation. It was like the media didn't know what to say. They were kind of holding their breath and waiting to see what the president decided before taking a stance on it. So it was a pretty surreal situation, actually.
You wrote in your piece that Albayrak's rise and dramatic fall is as much a story about how Turkey has changed under Erdogan as it is about Albayrak himself. What does it tell us about Turkey under Erdogan over the last 18 years? And more specifically, what does Erdogan's reliance on family members like Albayrak, what does that tell us about Erdogan's governance style?
Well, I think we've seen this very big kind of change in the style of Erdogan's leadership of the AKP over the 18 years that the party has been in power. I mean, in the early days, it really tried to present itself as a broad church. You know, the party and Erdogan has its roots in Islamist politics, but he formed a breakaway movement from the old Refah party and presented it as more modern, pro-European, business-friendly, more inclusive. And he tried to reflect that in the kind of types of people who were part of the party. And I think it's fair to say that there was a more diverse group of people in the party at that time. And what we've seen over the years is that there's been a steady consolidation of power by Erdogan, both within the AKP and also, I think, the Turkish state. And you see that because a lot of the kind of heavyweight figures who were very influential in the party in the early years, in the first decade, let's say, and a bit beyond, they're now gone. They're mostly outside of the tent. So you see that with Abdullah Gül, a co-founder who was also the president for some years. He's sort of on the sidelines now. You see that with Ali Babacan, the former economy minister and EU negotiator who quit the party last year to found his own party. Same with Ahmet Davutoğlu, the former prime minister. I mean, a lot of these figures are really loathed by people in Turkey's kind of leftist, secularist opposition. And I'm not saying you have to like them, but I think that they did act as a counterweight within the party. They had different views to Erdogan. They had different outlook. And people say that they were willing to express those views behind the scenes. But, you know, Erdogan's had a very rough ride as leader of the party and leader of Turkey. I think, you know, people who are more sympathetic to him say, you know, he's had an incredible array of challenges to his rule, whether that was the constitutional court trying to ban the party in the 2000s, whether it was the military trying to block his choice of president in Abdullah Gül. The Gezi Park protests were huge in 2013, and I think he found that a very frightening experience, even if many people were very critical of how he responded. He had corruption allegations against him levelled by members of the Gülen movement that same year. And then obviously there was the 2016 coup attempt, which was the biggest threat he's ever faced to his rule. And I think as a result of those things, people who know him and are trying to explain his behaviour say that he became more fearful, even paranoid. At the same time, there was a dynamic going on where he had also won a lot of elections. And he had this very big mandate, particularly in 2011, when he won almost 50% of the popular vote. So this kind of combination of like getting high on the back of the electoral success and being in power for, you know, more than 10 years, plus this array of threats seems to have made him more paranoid, more fearful, and ultimately retreated to the safety of family members. He became less willing to listen to internal critics and more inclined to pick people that he trusted around him. Now, I mean, the critics, including many people who used to be part of the party, say that this has just led to a very bad state of affairs, that he's hollowed out institutions, you know, whether it's the judiciary, whether it's economic policy-making institutions like the central bank, that he has surrounded himself by advisors who are a bunch of sycophants who aren't willing to speak the truth to him. And it's led to, you know, family members, whether it's his family members in the form of people like Berat Albayrak or family members of other AKP officials who've ended up being installed in institutions across the country. So that's a real trend that we've seen. And it really intensified, I think, after the coup and after President Erdogan brought in this very powerful presidential system in 2018, which further consolidated his power. So the story of Albayrak's rise is really a part of that picture. And it's incredibly interesting that he's been willing to jettison him after all of that.
Laura, there was a part of your piece when I was reading it that really shocked me. And that was the possibility that Albayrak had kept Erdogan in the dark on the true state of affairs when it came to the country's economy and the country's banks. Is it possible that Erdogan really did not know what was happening at Turkey's banks or when it came to Turkey's foreign reserves?
It's such an interesting question, and the people that I speak to are divided on it. The story that people in government and in the AKP tell is that although the president was aware of mounting discontent about the economy because he was hearing that from the public, he was hearing it from his own party, that he wasn't aware of all the details. So if you take the specific case of Turkey's foreign currency reserves, it's quite kind of easy to see how possibly he could have been presented with the gross reserve numbers, which look a lot better than the net reserve numbers. So when you strip out all the liabilities that the bank has and borrowed money that it has been counting as reserves in its coffers. Like, the situation is much, much worse than the headline numbers suggest. So, you know, Erdogan's defenders say that he didn't fully know and that Al-Bayrak was kind of pulling the wool over his eyes. Others say that that's completely absurd and that this is a president who likes to micromanage, who, you know, is on top of all sorts of details across government, works incredibly hard, and it's not possible that he didn't know. I mean, I do think the truth could be somewhere in the middle, that he had a vague sense, or even quite a good sense, that things were not going well, but that there were some certain details that he hadn't fully understood, like the reserves issue that I mentioned. But as Ali Babacan, one of his former top ministers, said recently, you know, kind of either situation is pretty bad. Either he didn't know, which is a fairly appalling position for the president of the nation to be in, or he did know and was sort of pretending otherwise or failing to do something about it.
A political analyst that you quoted in your piece said it's become clear that the Erdogan family isn't going to be a big factor after Erdogan. What do you think that this shakeup means for the future of Turkish politics? Erdogan obviously has lost what appears to be his heir apparent.
Yeah, well, the first thing I would say is that I'm not totally sure that Al-Bayrak has gone. I mean, I think it might be difficult for him to make a sort of spectacular return, but you never know. I mean, he spent a lot of time over the last 5 years or more recruiting loyalists into the state apparatus. I'll be watching quite closely to see what happens to those people, whether they keep their jobs. Other observers have pointed out that Al-Bayrak technically still maintains positions like on things like the Turkish Sovereign Wealth Fund. He hasn't been stripped of those thus far. So, you know, we'll have to see whether he really is gone or not. But either way, I think it does present a problem for Erdogan. I mean, I was never totally convinced of the idea that Al-Bayrak could be a successful heir to the president, because the polling showed that he was very unpopular and he was also unpopular within the party. But Erdogan has this problem that some analysts who I spoke to for the piece, you know, identified very articulately, which is that he seems to want to carry on in power as long as possible. I think that's partly because he's very ideologically committed to the project that he's leading and wants to continue on it and loves the job and has a great zeal for it and doesn't want to stop. But others say that he's also frightened of losing power, worried about the repercussions that might bring for him and his family. But either way, it's not that easy to see him just sort of stepping down and leaving in a conventional manner. Some of the opposition are quite optimistic that is going to happen, I should say. And obviously himself and the party would say that that's what he will do if he loses and the people don't want him anymore. But I do wonder, both from the perspective of, you know, worrying about protecting his family, but also protecting his legacy and the project that he spent so long working on, you would have thought that he would want to have some sort of plan in place about what happens to the party after he's gone. And it's not clear right now what that looks like. I think it probably won't be the top of his list of immediate concerns. Right now, that seems to be shoring up the economy a bit and shoring up his standing in the polling. But I'm sure it's something that will play on his mind. You know, if he really did think that Al-Bayrak could be someone who could take over one day from him, then there is clearly a bit of a gap there now.
Laura, I want to wrap up with a piece of news from today that you reported on and that you posted about on Twitter. Turkey's new central bank governor announced its biggest interest rate rise in 2+ years as Turkey looks like it's heading in a different direction now. Do you think that this will hold given Erdogan's fierce opposition to interest rate hikes in the past?
Well, that's a massive question, right? I mean, I think what we've seen from today's decision is that he clearly has given the new governor, Naci Ağbal, the room, the green light to do what Naci Ağbal thinks is needed, and that's what most economists and investors think is needed, which is to raise rates and to stabilize the currency, to bring in some foreign capital that's really badly needed. But I mean, we're going to have to see whether or not President Erdogan allows that to continue. I mean, I find it unlikely that he's had a massive change in ideology in terms of how he views high interest, how he views the best way to run the economy, which in his eyes is to not have overly high rates so that you can encourage investment and growth. And so I think the concern among a lot of the investors that I speak to and a lot of the analysts I speak to is that this will be a short-lived thing, and that after allowing the new governor to stabilize the situation over the next 6 months or so, that the pressure will come back to cut rates again, and that that could push Turkey into a new cycle of, you know, pressure on the currency due to credit-fueled growth, which is what we've seen several times now over the last 10 years.
Laura, thanks for joining us today on The Greek Current. It was great speaking with you.
Thanks for having me.
In other news, Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis and the heir to the throne of the United Arab Emirates met in Abu Dhabi on Wednesday and affirmed their common stance against Turkish aggression in the Eastern Mediterranean, the Middle East, and the Caucasus. Both countries issued a joint declaration and signed a defense and foreign policy cooperation agreement. Moreover, Greece pledged in the joint declaration to contribute to the strengthening of historical and friendly ties between the UAE and the European Union. The two leaders also described trade, investment, tourism, culture, energy, digital and government services, and agriculture as pillars of bilateral cooperation. Meanwhile, the head of the Orthodox Church of Greece, Archbishop Hieronymos, has been hospitalized after being diagnosed with COVID-19. The archbishop had met with Prime Minister Mitsotakis on Saturday, but government spokesman Stelios Petsas said both men had undergone a coronavirus test before the meeting and the results had been negative. The recent death of a senior clergyman in the Greek Orthodox Church, however, has revived a debate over the safety of receiving communion during the pandemic, as a shared spoon is used for the whole congregation. In the meantime, the northern city of Thessaloniki continued to report the highest number of new coronavirus infections in Greece. That wraps up today's Daily Roundup. Thanks for tuning in.